It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. With the number of cases still rising nationwide, President Donald Trump promised the government would purchase thousands of ventilators to care for people critically ill with COVID-19. Now, reporting from ProPublica shows the government was thinking about the need to stockpile these devices as far back as 5 years ago. That's when they signed a contract with a company in Murrysville to develop and produce them, so the U.S. would have plenty on hand just in case of a pandemic. But that company hasn't delivered. Tim Golden is an editor-at-large for ProPublica and one of three journalists behind an investigation that dropped earlier this week. Tim, thanks for joining me.
Happy to be with you.
So under this $13.8 million government contract, what was Philips Respironics supposed to provide?
The original contract was for the design of a new kind of lightweight, portable, easy-to-use ventilator, a kind of a modification of what are called transport ventilators that are used inside hospitals to move a patient from one place to another or to medevac somebody in a helicopter, for instance. And what they wanted was a more adaptable transport ventilator that could be used with patients ranging from elderly people to small newborn infants and could be used in a case of a pandemic so that you had something that was fairly rugged and easy to use for people that you could distribute widely if you had a situation like the current one.
Was there a timeline on this project?
Well, the timeline originally, I think, was a three-year contract, and then the device was designed. It was essentially made. It was moved through the regulatory process by Philips with the help of the government. That's kind of part of what the Special Office of the Health and Human Services Administration that worked with them does. They help you get past the regulators and bring the device to market. And this was always something that Philips could use also as a commercial venture. They could adapt the device that the government was asking to make for a pandemic situation and create something that could be sold commercially as well. So they did both of those things. They got past the FDA. And then late last year, the government signed a separate contract with them in September that was for the delivery of 10,000 of the devices at about $3,200 a piece.
But I take it that did not happen. What happened instead?
Well, the government gave Philips a very long time to make these devices. They didn't have to start making them under that contract until August of 2020, and they didn't have to complete the contract for two more years. So they didn't start making them. Instead, they started making the commercial models, two different commercial models that they're selling already all over the world. So what happened was that Philips ended up making the two commercial models that it's going to make at a higher profit and started selling them around the world. The pandemic hit, and the government wasn't really quick to say, hey, you owe us, Philips, because we paid to design this ventilator for just this kind of an emergency.
What has the company told you about why it's not making the portable ventilators as they promised, at least not making the ones for the HHS before it makes its commercial ones?
Philips has said that essentially this is part of the deal, that they're within their rights to do that. And the government, I think, essentially agrees. The problem is that the taxpayers paid almost $14 million to Philips to create this design. And from the beginning of this project, the government has been trying to do something like this since 2008. It's always been a requirement that the company be able to make these in a hurry if there was an emergency. So now there's an emergency, and Philips is saying, well, because we haven't started making that particular model, it's too time-consuming for us to stop production on the other ones and build this one that we were supposed to build for a pandemic. Instead, they're negotiating with the White House and the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, about supposedly delivering 43,000 different ventilators that are used in hospitals on a hurried-up schedule.
Well, what's the difference between those that are used in a hospital setting versus the more portable, flexible device that was imagined to begin with?
A hospital ventilator can cost $50,000 or even more, and it's a fairly complex machine that has to be used by a respirator tech. And the ventilators that the government wanted to have were things that would be much simpler to use, and something that somebody who is a medical technician or even a nurse with less training could use in a situation like the one that we have now, where we're having field hospitals being created in the middle of Central Park and people needing help in all kinds of different situations.
You mentioned President Trump. He authorized the Defense Production Act to conscript some manufacturers into work like this. General Motors, for example, may be roped into the ventilator-making business as well. Do you think that that will have any impact here with this Pennsylvania-based Philips subsidiary?
Well, there's two laws that would give the government a possible claim to the design that they created with Philips for this kind of respirator. There's the Defense Production Act. There's also a second law that specifically says that the government can take over a design in an emergency like this. And it's just kind of a question of whether they can move fast enough and figure out a way to get the many parts that a ventilator, like even like this relatively simpler one, would need, and get those parts supplied in a very quick way.
So has the government then, the Department of Health and Human Services, responded at all?
They haven't given any indication that they're doing that, but the sense that we get is that they're not leading these negotiations that the White House is having with various automakers and ventilator companies. So it's kind of hard to tell. There seems to be a fair amount of disorganization, because every day that we were talking to government people and to Philips, they all seem to kind of be expecting something different, and the goalposts seem to be moving. So it's not clear that you have a situation in which government experts are sweeping out and getting together with manufacturers and suppliers and convening everybody who could be convened to try to figure out how to solve this problem.
And what about Philips? Do you know if they feel any sort of pride or responsibility to contribute right now?
It's hard to tell. I mean, we asked them straight up, hey, don't you have a moral obligation to the American people who paid for the design and the creation of this device for exactly this kind of a situation? But, I think their story is that they're trying to manufacture ventilators as fast as they can. Whether that's what we really need is kind of hard to tell, because we don't have a lot of visibility into the negotiations that are happening, and you don't really know what other kind of ventilators might be made by other companies.
Well, and in any good investigation, there's always a million more questions to ask. What will your team be looking at as this story and the pandemic itself moves forward?
I think we're looking at the same thing that everybody who does the kind of work we do is looking at, which is trying to understand how the government is responding in this situation and what it should be doing and what might be going wrong and how we can try to get the best information to people about how to fix it.
Tim Golden is an editor-at-large for ProPublica. We'll have a link to his piece about the still forthcoming Trilogy Evo Universal Ventilator on our website at WESA.FM. Tim, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Governor Tom Wolf's shelter-in-place order is now statewide. The directives are meant to save lives, but for victims of domestic violence, staying at home can be extremely dangerous. 90.5 WESA's Lucy Perkins reports.
When the stay-at-home order was first issued for Allegheny County, Michelle Gibb expected to see a lot more calls to her domestic violence hotline. Gibb knew that victims would be under the same roof all day with their abusers, but instead, the phones rang less.
Which is one of those slap your forehead things, because of course they're decreasing, because survivors would call us when the abuser left, or they would call us when they were at work.
Gibb runs the Allakiskey Area Hope Center, which provides services and shelter to victims of domestic violence. She says that because victims don't have the privacy to call and ask for help, organizations in the region have been trying to push other lines of communication. Anyone can text, email, or Facebook message the Hope Center, too.
But that presents its own unique challenges because, you know, a telephone call, they can delete the number from their call history. But depending on what types of media they contact us through, then we have to like figure out all of the ways to delete that contact.
So if it's an email, for example, make sure to delete it from your sent folder and then delete it from your deleted folder. But there are other lifelines too. Gibb says if you regularly talk to someone experiencing domestic violence, come up with a code word for them to use in a crisis.
A totally innocuous code word that if the person needs an intervention beyond checking in, that you can call 911. Like, say, birthday cake, if you need me to call 911.
In fact, as the state began shutting down, 911 calls went up. That could mean victims are only able to call when their situation poses immediate danger. The Pittsburgh Bureau of Police says calls related to domestic violence were 20% higher once the stay-at-home order was in place. There was also a 30% jump in verbal domestic calls, arguments that haven't escalated to physical violence yet.
So when there are situations that people are fearful for their lives, they're calling 911, thankfully, still.
Nicole Molinaro is the president and CEO of the Women's Shelter of Greater Pittsburgh. Her shelter saw a big drop in calls, too. She says as the coronavirus rapidly shut down so many businesses, a lot of people weren't sure if shelters would be open. But over time, numbers started to increase again.
We just had one of our residents say how relieved she is that she and her children are in our shelter and not in their home during this time. She can't even imagine the violence that they would be experiencing if they were at home with her abuser right now.
But some survivors have another concern. How do you social distance at a shelter? Both Gibb and Molinaro say their facilities are being vigilantly cleaned, and the women's shelter has common areas that are big enough to social distance in. Molinaro says help will continue to be available for anyone who needs it, regardless of the pandemic.
The people who were vulnerable to begin with this pandemic, they might have been teetering on the edge to begin with and now have gone over the edge. So we really need to be that safety net now more than ever. That can help vulnerable populations.
That priority is reflected in the justice system, too. Even though many routine court proceedings have been suspended, protection from abuse orders, or PFAs, are still being granted. Lindsay Tajani is director of domestic violence services at the Hope Center. She says victims can request a PFA by going to the municipal courts building next to the county jail between 8 a.m. and 2 p.m. The whole process will take 1 or 2 hours. A temporary PFA ordinarily lasts about 2 weeks until a court date is set. But Tajani says during the pandemic, temporary orders will last until courts start operating normally.
So your order is good until the courts open back up and a final hearing is scheduled again.
Anyone who calls the 24-hour national hotline will automatically be connected to a local center that can help. The number is 1-800-799-7233. I'm Lucy Perkins, 90.5 WESA News.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. During the coronavirus shutdown, people seem to be reading more. But how are actual bookstores doing in Pittsburgh? 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll has this report from a few local independent shops.
Like many of us these days, Jill Yeomans is working from home.
I'm standing in my office right now looking at, I've got all these books laid out.
Yeomans and her husband, Adlai, co-own White Whale Bookstore in Bloomfield. But she's talking from Point Breeze, 10 days after her store went dark due to the pandemic.
I think we brought about 10 boxes of books, say about maybe 25 books in each box. So, yeah, couple hundred.
Their stash includes mostly newer books, like Hilary Mantel's best-selling The Mirror and the Light and local novelist Claire Beam's The Illness Lesson. Mailing from home is one way Yeomans is filling online orders, the only kind she can during the shutdown. And online orders have risen for White Whale, but that can't make up for the loss of in-person sales, the bread and butter of most indie shops. White Whale sells the books at every Pittsburgh Arts and Lectures event, the largest of which draw more than 1,000 patrons. Add in frequent in-store readings, and White Whale makes about half its sales at events. All that's gone, along with any kind of walk-in traffic, says Yeomans.
It's already been completely devastating for our business.
10 years ago, indie bookshops seemed near extinction in the U.S. The decade has seen a surprising resurgence. There are now about 2,500 such stores, up 50% from 2009, according to the American Booksellers Association. Pittsburgh alone has a dozen or more. But despite anecdotal evidence that quarantined Pittsburghers are reading more, booksellers, like most retailers, are anxious about cratering sales.
Let me just do some math on the paper.
Eric Ackland owns Amazing Books and Records with stores in Squirrel Hill in downtown.
I've done about a third of what I would have done otherwise.
He's laid off 4 of his 5 employees. With the shutdown extended through April, he worries about making rent. Ackland, too, is focusing on growing online sales.
I'm really working super hard at it. I guess they've gone up 50%.
Roughly half of all book sales in the U.S. already happen online, and now many stores are adding discounts and free shipping. Some of them work with Ingram Publisher Services, an international company with a warehouse in central Pennsylvania that has remained open as an essential business during the shutdown. Others use Bookshop.org, a new online store created to support indie shops in the age of Amazon. Bookshop.org lets each visitor choose a store to shop through, and that store gets a 25% commission on any sales. Other book merchants have tried novel schemes. Arlen Hess, who owns City Books on the north side, isn't set up for online sales. Instead, she's teamed with 2 other retailers on mail-order care packages. A banned books-themed candle and a special tea blend are matched with one of Hess's Blind Date with a Book selections, usually a classic, wrapped in brown paper and sold on Etsy. The care packages got off to a good start last week.
24 hours, not even 24 hours. We've sold out and had to start a second batch.
Still, patrons, and booksellers too, are missing one thing you can't get online, face-to-face interaction. As White Whale's Yeoman says,
our customer base supports us because they want to physically come into our store generally and talk to us and get recommendations from our booksellers and be able to have that in-person bookstore experience.
Christy Bodner co-owns Mystery Lovers Bookshop in Oakmont. She says the effects of social distancing seem strongest among the longtime regulars.
We've noticed some people are calling and they're placing orders, but then we'll spend another 15 or 20 minutes sometimes just talking to them on the phone because not only are we not interacting with people, but they're not either.
Yeomans says White Whale too feels the love from fans, especially when it posts on social media.
Each time we've given an update, we've seen sort of a big rush of orders come through. So that's felt really, really good.
But is there enough online revenue out there to let indie bookstores write their next chapter? Ackland of Amazing Books says there is only one way to be sure.
So if you want bookstores in your neighborhoods, you've really got to buy from your local bookstores.
I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. To learn more about how the spread of the new coronavirus is affecting our region, go to WESA's coronavirus blog. It's updated throughout the day at WESA.fm. The Confluence is also a podcast. Find us wherever you listen in. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Kevin Gavin, and Kylie Kaczynski. Until next time, I'm Megan Harris. Please be safe and have a good day of good news.